Good morning, 9 a.m. How are we doing out there? Certainly willing to laugh a little bit today, huh? And I heard some worship out of you and some prayers, so that's great. Hey, before we jump into Daniel part number 4 today, just a couple things to celebrate that I think were tremendous this past week and weekend. Last week came to you sharing our challenge in going to Mexico in October. This is our biggest construction project we've ever taken on and our biggest outlay of financial commitment to go and to do that project. We're looking to raise $25,000 to buy all the materials for this roof system again, which is a stretch for us. We came to you, we talked to you about that, introduced you to the pastor there, or reintroduced if you met him when he was here in previous years. And then, of course, we're sending a group in October to go put the roof on. And came to you and talked to you a little bit about that financial need. And as of last weekend, had nothing to do with the gifts that came in this week or this weekend. I want to show you this little chart of where we're at. 8,000 towards the 25,000. Give the Lord a round of applause. Isn't that great? And I didn't doubt that we could do it, but I kind of wondered. We've never really done a summer, you know, offering like this. And I just feel like it's not going to be long. In a couple of weeks, we're going to be like, we're there. We made it happen. And that's really, really cool. So also wanted to mention the registration for who's going to Mexico ends today. So if you have been on the fence and been thinking about it, now's the time to jump to get registered so we can really start pulling things together and believing by faith that the rest of the money is going to come in and we're going to get a good jump on that project, at least do our best to try to make it happen. I also wanted to mention, too, if you want to give, you can do it through the offering envelope. Just be sure and mark Mexico Summer Missions. If you give online, there's also a tab that's designated for Summer Offering Mexico Missions, and it will get to the right place. I also wanted to thank the volunteers who helped with the Whitefield School District number 3 pack bash yesterday. It was at Grand Mesa. We were the primary sponsor of it. We contributed money to help buy backpacks, and a whole team from the church was a part of organizing that and helping, and it was just really, really amazing. I want to especially thank the Doc family just for their boldness. They set up 2 tents that had the restoration moniker on it. They gave away 30 student Bibles to families, tracks, prayed with people, ministered to people, and it was really just amazing, you know, to just see salt and light amongst the community there and just making a difference. So appreciate everyone who was there, you know, passing out backpacks, help organize it, all the different kind of people. You did a great job. Really, really, really proud of you guys. Clayton, just a little bit of a ring in the mic there. If you could see if you can adjust that would be great. All right, so welcome to part number 4 of the book of Daniel. I want to take just a few moments before we get to the new content to give us a flyover of where we've been in the first couple weeks, because Daniel is a fairly complicated book. There's so much to glean that I think it'd be worth just sort of setting the context before we get to the new content here. So 2 really big events in the Old Testament when you read it, and if you can wrap your head around these 2 events, it'll help you understand the Old Testament a lot better. Both of these big events start with the letter E, so that's another easy way to remember it. The first is the Exodus, the second is the exile. These 2 things stand in complete opposite, complete contrast with one another. In as much as one is good, the other is bad. In as much as one is rejoicing, the other is totally defeat, right? So the Exodus was a time of great liberty and celebration for the nation of Israel. They had been in slavery and captivity for 400 years in the Egyptian Empire under the pharaohs who ruled and reigned. They were stonemasons. They helped build a lot of the greatness of Egypt in different parts, right? And they got tired of being slaves and they cried out for a deliverer. God raised up Moses. Moses, with the empowerment of God, was able to bring plagues upon that nation, break the back of the Pharaoh. God's people were liberated and was singing and dancing and rejoicing. They left that slavery and they began to make their way to the promised land. This is a high, 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 high point in the Old Testament. The contrast to that is the exile, which will come later. God's people were living in the promised land. They had established Jerusalem. David and Solomon helped provide the provisions and build the temple. God's people were doing amazing, but the kings after David and Solomon had wicked, hard hearts, stiff necks, led the people down roads of unrighteousness. God allowed the Babylonians to come in and to haul away the riches of the temple, the greatness of the temple. They destroyed the temple, and they began to exile people in 3 different ways to go live in Babylonian captivity for 70 years. This was a time of crying, of depression, of discouragement, of bondage. In as good as the Exodus was, that's how bad the exile was. Daniel's about 17 years old when he's exiled. He goes in the first wave with about 70 high and promising sharp young people, and he's put in the king's service where he goes through 3 years of training before he would serve the king. And it's during these 70 years that this young man is going to be a source of hope and resilience to a very defeated nation. He is going to encourage them. He's going to show them what it means to walk through trial and tribulation when the faith is tested, when the nation is dark, when everything is against God's people. He's going to show what hope and resilience is. So in chapter 1, Daniel and his friends are relocated to Babylon, where they encounter what I call the Babylonian spirit, or the spirit of Babylon. Babylon is a bad place. It's been since day one in the Bible, and it's going to be to the final day in the Bible. Babylon is the exact opposite of Jerusalem. It's an evil city. It's a wicked city, okay? Jerusalem is a good city, a promise that, well, they are relocated from the good city, Jerusalem, to the bad city, Babylon, with all of that stuff. And they encounter this evil spirit that seeks to push their core identity and to cause them to question things. They're legally renamed. Their beautiful Hebrew God-centered names are ripped away from them, and legally they're told that they have to take on these new names, which represents the God of Babylon. They're tempted with the king's table and all of these foods of delicacy, but these Daniel and his three friends have conviction, and they're good at saying yes to God, and they resist that, and the Lord blesses them for their sacrifice, for loving him more than they love their flesh, and God makes them, listen closely, 10 times better. And isn't that cool to think that when we honor God, he has the ability to make us 10 times better. Then we move to chapter 2, and again, all this stuff is review. Daniel has a big problem because King Nebuchadnezzar has this dream and this vision, and no one can interpret it. He prays, he seeks God, and God gives him the meaning of this dream, which was four successive Gentile empires that will lead up and will finalize the rule of man. All the brokenness, the sinfulness of our governments that we've set up will culminate into what we call the millennial reign, the thousand-year reign of Jesus, when Jesus is going to come back and heal this earth and heal the people, make everything right. It's going to be an amazing time, and we got to fast forward. Guys, how many know that our best days lie ahead? That God's got some amazing stuff for us, and we focus on the millennial kingdom. So we have this wonderful future waiting for us. So as a result of successfully interpreting the dream of chapter 2, Daniel and his friends are elevated out of this three-year training program, and they're brought into the service of the king. And now we pick up the new content in chapter 3. Chapter 3 brings us to one of the most famous stories in all of the Bible. It's so epic that even VeggieTales devoted a whole episode towards it. How many remember these guys? This is some high-quality entertainment right here, people. I'm telling you, man. And they took and they devoted an entire episode, and they called it Rack, Shack, and Benny. And they retell the story of Daniel chapter 3 through the eyes of these characters. And man, when my kids were little, this was the way to make a road trip possible, like VeggieTales, right? And just teaches so much truth. So bucket list this summer, okay, before kids go back to school and all this kind of stuff, you got to watch Rack, Shack, and Benny. So this cartoon, this illustration, if you will, of VeggieTales really gives us sort of an idea of just how great this chapter is. So we're going to walk you through this chapter, and we're going to point out four scenes of fiery trial and how this trial against Daniel's friends happens, where it happens, and what are some of the significant things behind the phases or the scenes of this trial. So number one, the trial begins on the plains of Babylon in chapter 3, 1, verse 7. And I've also put underneath this idea of when the state becomes God. And what do we do as people when the state gets so arrogant and so prideful that they begin to overreach and the state begins to act like God in people's lives? Well, this is a great illustration of that. So Babylon was this prideful city, and it was led by a very prideful king named Nebuchadnezzar. And when King Nebuchadnezzar was told by Daniel that he was the head on the statue, and he was the head of gold, and we talked about this last week, I think it really went to his head, pardon the pun. He thought so highly of himself that he constructed a massive gold statue in his image and in his likeness. He prominently displayed it, and he asked, commanded, forced an edict that it should be nationally worshipped. Chapter 3, verse number 1, and King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold 60 cubits high and 60 cubits wide. So imagine about 90 foot tall and about 9 foot wide. And he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, and magistrates. I need a round of applause for getting through that. And all of the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So all of those people that I just described assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. So this statue is going to be erected on the plains of Dura. The plains of Dura would look like eastern Colorado, where you can see from here through Kansas and all the way to the East Coast, right? Very flat, very just kind of mundane out there. Now imagine this 90-foot statue. That's how big the statue was. It was probably sitting on some kind of platform that elevated it to held it. So you're talking about 100 foot on these flat plains. People could see this for miles, and they were commanded to come throughout this great Babylonian empire where the statue was erected, and they were commanded to worship it. Verse number 4, then the herald loudly proclaimed, and this was a law in the land, nations and people in every language, this is what you were commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, and the pipe, I need another round of applause, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship, notice this, will be immediately thrown into the blazing furnace. So as the masses gathered, both small and great, you hear the names of all of these high-level people throughout the government. So you have rich people, you have poor people, you have everywhere in between. They gather and they're told, you must worship, otherwise be punished by death via a fiery furnace. Verse number 7. Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of all those musical instruments, the nations, the people of every language fell down and worshiped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So here on the plains of Dura was the first test, the first trial. And the Babylonian government, listen closely, chose to act like God. Worship this image, not the true and living God, this image of this man. Now listen closely. And for the most part, the citizens allowed the government to act like God. Do you see the double failure there? When a government tries to be God and when the people let the government become God. During the past 3 years, we've seen our government do some unbelievable things. And for the most part, most citizens allowed the government to act like God in our lives the last 3 years. Consider just 3 years ago at COVID, when people started figuring out what was going on and how bad it was or wasn't, and all the different types of things. Do you realize Nevada let casinos open but kept churches closed for months? That is a government that's acting like God in Nevada. California fined some churches up to $1 million for holding church services while they opened liquor stores across the state of California. Think about that. Many tyrannical employers, with the encouragement of the government, said to people like you, take the jab or lose your job. Put people in very difficult situations and circumstances to make huge choices in their life. And we see that government has this propensity, right, to overreach, to get in people's life, and sometimes even act like God in their life. But there's also this sort of guilt that time falls upon the people when people allow their government to do these things, to say these things, when we're quiet, when we don't push back, when things are just blatantly messed up. And you see this, just this terrible storm brewing of this arrogant government and the people that overly submit. So I want to raise the question, what is the likelihood of being persecuted for your convictions when you differ from the government moving forward? Like, what do you think are the chances the next year, 2 years, 5 years, should the Lord tarry and allow us to be here, of more government acting like God and the challenges that come along with that? I think there are a couple areas in which we will have to deal with this in the months and years to come. And it's all patterned around this idea of what's being described throughout the world right now as ESGs. And that terminology is environmental, social, and governmental policies that are taking shape. The environmental is basically this: when the government begins to measure the carbon footprint that an individual or a household or a business puts out. So if you're buying into the idea of oil and carbon kind of stuff, you're put in a category where you are a bad citizen, right? As you try to get out of those types of things, quote, you are a good citizen. The social is this idea of diversity and equity in our culture. In other words, how do you think, how do you feel about these gender issues and the pride movement and fluid gender and these types of things? And if you agree with that type of stuff, more favor with the government, less favor if you don't. The G has to do with the governance and your willingness to tolerate whatever government wants to do, even when they think that they're God. There are things now going on in our society, no lie, you can do some research, and I'll give you some examples of how to do that in just a moment, of where businesses now are given ESG scores. So all of these big businesses that are running the world, and you know who they are, all that they call them the FANG companies, Facebook, right, Google, these different types of huge corporations that are out there. They're very involved with helping set up these scores that are connected with businesses. And that's why Target can lose $12 billion and not even really blink an eye over their social disposition towards these things in our society. They can lose all this money and be okay because they have a high score on this ESG system, and they find favor with these big organizations and with governments, right? And that's why you're seeing Budweiser do the, because you just think, how could a company lose $12 billion, even if, because it has to do with this ESG score. And one of the things that's coming online right now in Europe, and most things start in Europe, then they make their way to America, is what they're calling 15-minute cities. And this comes from Harbinger's Daily. It came out this past week. And this is a test experiment that's going on in England, in Oxford. And what they're doing in Oxford is they've created what they call a 15-minute city. And here's the idea. And it sounds a little utopic, and it sounds pretty cool until you really start trying to apply it to a place like the Fountain Valley. All right, the idea is that you don't travel more than 15 minutes away from your house so that you can limit your carbon footprint. And what they've done in this city is they've installed $6.5 million or pounds, I should say it's actually more than that in dollars, but in pounds, they've created these camera systems all over Oxford to monitor how many times you drive through certain intersections, and you're given passes to drive through this intersection X amount of time. But beyond that, then you get a fine in the mail, much like you would if you get a speeding ticket through a camera. So it says here that unauthorized vehicles going through traffic filters can therefore be identified, and any car that goes through the traffic filter that is not exempt will be issued a fine. It was proposed that the residents of Oxfordshire County will be issued 25 day passes per vehicle per year, with a maximum of one car and one person, two vehicles per household. Residents in the Oxford City permit area most affected by the plan would receive a maximum of 100 day passes per vehicle per year. Now get this, the City Council of Oxford received over 5,700 comments when they went public with what they wanted to do. 93% of people opposed this measure. 7% were for it, and they forced it down the people's throat, all in the name of this ESG and curbing carbon. Imagine Fountain being a 15-minute city. And imagine in year one, two, 3 years from now, if America goes headlong over serving the green God, and that's what it is, environmentalism is becoming the new God. This is conjecture here, but my sense when I read Romans chapter 1, that towards the time of the end, people will not worship the creator, but they will worship what does it say? The creation. in the creation will be elevated above God, and people will worship that. And this green monster is developing all over the world. The most powerful people are bringing down these ESG types of things across the globe. And what will happen when the government acts like God? How will we respond? Will we as the people let them act like God, or will we push back? And I think these are very relevant things for where we're headed. Maybe saying that's in Europe, Paul. Well, let me bring it home. I've banked at U.S. Bank since I was 16 years old, I think. And I've been kind of watching U.S. Bank and how they're going to handle ESG. And they're, my bank, since I was 16, is fully in love with ESG. I bet unless you're a part of a local credit union, your big bank system is worshiping the green god. I can almost guarantee it. And what this ESG is doing for a place like a bank is they want to take your investment dollars, if you have a high yield interest-bearing account, and they want to back, listen closely, companies that reflect ESG. Do a little research on what societal norms are for these big businesses and what they prefer and how they view things like transgenderism and sex changes to kids and all this kind of stuff. This is the type of stuff that they want to back those types of companies and types of things. So at this level, it's a little bit benign. Doesn't seem like a big deal. It's far removed for us. But what happens if they move from giving ESG scores to businesses to local households? And let's say you don't think the same way about carbon that other people do. And you don't think the same way about these transgender issues as a lot of people do. And you receive a low ESG score and you want to get a different kind of house or take advantage of interest rates that are changing, and they all of a sudden you're frowned upon because you don't meet the ESG standards. Friends, that's what we're talking about here. And this is the type of thinking that's beginning to erupt all around the world. And the government has acted like God in the past, and it will do so in the future. And I think that this is a fact. And let me tell you how I get there. The Bible is a prophetic book. It's prophetic in that it tells us what happened in the past, and it tells us what's going to happen in the future. So as we read our Bible, there are these little movie clips, these little movie trailers. And we get these little reads in different parts of the Bible that show us parts of what the movie is going to be like in the future. So in Babylon in the past, this arrogant king and his arrogant government allowed this image to be built, and they forced people to worship. That's what happened in the past. Let me show you what's going to happen in the future. There is a man who's going to be deemed as the Antichrist at the time of the end in the Great Tribulation period that is going to build an image, and guess what he's going to want? Worship. What happened in the past is going to happen in the future. We are in between all of that stuff, but that spirit of Antichrist, that Babylonian spirit that existed then, will be the same Babylonian spirit that will happen in the future. And we fight that Babylonian spirit as it tries to manifest itself. So let me take you to Revelation chapter 13, verse 5. And the beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise its authority for 42 months, 3.5 years. And it opened its mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. It was given power to wage war against God's holy people and to conquer them. And it was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. And all inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast and all those whose names have not been written in the Lamb's Book of Life, who was slain from the creation of the world. Let's go to Revelation chapter 13, verse 11, and pair these verses up with this information. And then I saw a second beast coming out of the earth that had two horns like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon. It exercised all the authority of the first beast on its behalf, and it made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. And it performed great signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of the people. Because of the signs it was given power to perform on behalf of the first beast, it deceived the inhabitants of the earth, and it ordered them, listen closely, to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And the second beast was given power to breathe to the image of the first beast so that the image could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. And so it forced all people, great and small, rich, poor, slave and free, to receive a mark on their right hands or on their foreheads so that they could not buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of its name. And there is this day coming, friends, when this type of image will be erected, much like it was on the plain of Dura in Babylon way back then, that will be repeated, that will demand worship. The state will become God one more time. And for anyone who refuses the second time around in the future, friends, will be punishable again by death, much like King Nebuchadnezzar's reign. The Bible is a prophetic book that tells us what was and what is coming. So let's make this real. This was probably the hardest test of loyalty that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had to overcome in their entire life. Now in chapter 1, they abstained from food at the king's table, and that probably was a test and a challenge. But it wasn't as great as surrendering their life for rejecting the worship of this image. How many know that sooner or later as a Christian, your values are going to be tested? Sooner or later, you'll not be able to blend in with the crowd. Sooner or later, everyone will bow and you will have to make that hard decision in your life that counts, that is difficult. And while the masses bow down, there are a few that will remain standing. They will know the difference of what they're called to do. In those moments, they will stand for righteousness. How many know that standing for God can be lonely? When the masses are bowing, when your peers are saying it's okay. Daniel 3, verse 7. Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and people of every language fell down and worshiped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. One by one, the crowds bowed, rich, poor, everyone in between, young, old, they all bowed down. And while the crowds bowed down to an idol and a false god, there were three men who refused to kneel. And someone noticed these three men standing and they ratted them out. Verse number 12. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, King, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up. And on the plains of Dura is the first fiery trial and the test. So now let's transition to the next stage of this trial. And it's when these men were in the king's presence and they had to talk to him about not bowing down. And they make this incredible statement that I want to point out here in the notes. Our God is able, implication, to save us, but if not, we will face the consequences. Notice verse 16. Shadrach and Abednego replied to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it. And he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. This is the type of scripture that we read where we have to pause for just a moment. As modern people, we read the scripture sometimes in black and white, and we think these are different people than us. You know, they didn't have real fears, and there wasn't real flesh and blood on them. We got to pause and see. We got to see the color in the story. These were real human beings, guys. We're not talking like Superman here. We're not talking like Wonder Woman. Guys, they had apprehension. They had fears. It's possible that these men may have families. Might have had a baby on the way at this stage. Think about all that they were risking by not bowing down. This was punishable by death. And they're face to face with the superpower of the world, face to face with King Nebuchadnezzar. And they're saying this, we are not bowing down to you or to your gods. And this was bold. This was courageous. Think about it. They could have maybe caved and said, you know, we'll take a knee, but in our hearts, we won't worship. And we'll just kind of blend in. But that was not the case. They stood up. They defied when the government tried to be God. How is a person able to do such an enormous thing? Like, how do you reach a point in time where your faith is so strong that you're willing to die for it? This is how it works. Early in those guys' life, they got good at saying yes to God. One morning, on a Monday morning, they woke up and they said yes to spending time with God privately. On Tuesday, they woke up and they said yes to God in terms of worshiping Him and seeking Him. On a Wednesday, one afternoon, they woke up and they said, I'm going to be obedient with my time. On a Thursday, they woke up and they said, I'm going to be obedient with my treasures and I'm going to give to God even when it hurts and I'm going to obey Him. And they started saying yes to God over patterns of their life. And then when it came to be in the training program and the king said, here's the food I want you to eat. And when it was non-kosher and when there was meat that was offered to idols or had blood in it or pig meat type of stuff that Jews didn't tolerate, they had a big stand and they stood up and said, we cannot do that. And it was all those yeses to God that culminated to that point and place that when it came to life or death, they had no problem because they had been saying yes to God for a whole bunch of weeks, months, and years. That's how you do something impossible. You start this week, friends, and you know what I'm talking about. When the Holy Spirit begins to speak to you this week, and you just sense that nudge inside that you need to be with Him in the Word, and you say yes. And next week, you're obedient at your school or your workplace by offering hope to someone who's really going through a hard time. And I don't have the words to say. I don't know how to do it. But you're obedient and you say yes to God and you minister to that person, right? You start giving of your time and your talent and your resources, all these slow nudges. And all of a sudden, this muscle-bound spiritual person inside of you gets stronger and stronger to when it's really, really, really serious. You have no problem saying yes to Him because you got good at saying yes to Him a long time ago. And that's what's happened in these guys' life. They're not about to compromise. And I want to encourage you, church, to remain faithful to God. No matter what trials that you face, trust Him and lean into His promises. And here's one of the wonderful promises that we have, Isaiah 43, verse 1 and 2. Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have summoned you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, what does God say? I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, what does God say? They will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fires, what does God say? You will not be burned. And this is the type of faith that God can allow to well up within you, friends. And that's what we're talking about here. The next phase of that trial was in the king's presence, in that statement that my God is able to deliver me, end of story. But if He chooses not, I'm okay with that too, because I'm not bowing to you, O great king, nor your idols. Number three, the next stage of the trial was at the fiery furnace. And it's in this that I've put the words, when our witness is crystal clear. And this is such an encouraging point to lay out. So let's begin reading in verse 19. Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach and Beni. And I'm playing off the VeggieTales here, right? I know that's not technically his name. And his attitude towards them changed. He ordered the furnaces to be heated, notice this, 7 times hotter than usual. And he commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach and Beni, throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men wearing robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. And the king's command was so urgent and the furnace was so hot that the flames of fire killed the soldiers who took Shadrach and Bendigo. And these three men firmly tied fell into the blazing furnace. Now let's think about verse 24. Then King Nebuchadnezzar, an unbeliever at this stage in his life, leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, weren't there 3 men that were tied up and thrown into the fire? And they replied, certainly, your majesty. Then he said, look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the 4th looks like a son of the gods or the son of God in other translations. Wow. Now watch this, friends. When the fire was the hottest, when the circumstances were the worst, when does the unbeliever see the presence of God manifested with believers? When you go through your worst, when the fire is the hottest in your life, you were probably at your best because that's when people see Jesus most clear in and around your life. Why does God allow us to go through pain and suffering and struggle and trial so that he can make himself known? And there was this prideful, arrogant king that needed a witness, that needed a testimony, whose heart needed to be changed, and he's going to be changed in the future chapters. God's going to get a hold of this wicked, arrogant, prideful, calling people to worship people to himself, God. This guy is going to get radically saved. Amen to that? But he needed a witness, and God needed someone to go through a trial so that God could make himself known to this king, friends. That fourth person in the fire becomes visible when we go through tough times. And the Lord is with us in the fire, and we are at our best when we're in the midst of the fire. Notice what King Nebuchadnezzar says in verse 28. He said, "Praise be to the God." Here's a guy who is wanting praise for himself. And now he's saying, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach and Beni, who has sent his angel to rescue his servants. They trusted in him. They defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any language who say anything against the God of Shadrach and Beni be cut to pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other god can save in this way." And then the king promoted Shadrach and Beni in the province of Babylon. So these trials are making their way from the plains of Dura, where the government chose to be God and people allowed the government to be God. The trial then gets more personal as they're in front of the king. The trial gets hotter as they're thrown into the furnace. And it all begins to resolve with the fourth phase of the trial, when these three men were next to the furnace. And I want to end with this idea with point number four here. The point's going to come here. Why does God save some people and others not? I think this is a really good question. For each believer that God saves, there's usually one that he does not. And how many know that sometimes even the most faithful people are not saved in the trial, in the fire? Let me show you what I mean. Consider first the disciples. There was only one disciple that did not die a martyr's death. John, the guy who wrote the book of Revelation, who wrote the Gospels, who wrote 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. He's the only disciple that died a natural death. Wasn't a nice natural death. He was banished to the Isle of Patmos, right, where he wrote the book of Revelation, lonely, isolated, alone, probably a very tough type of death. He was the only one who aged out and died a natural death. Every single one of the other disciples was not rescued. Peter was crucified upside down in Rome, where the Vatican is today. All of them, very brutal, painful deaths that God did not rescue them from. Example number two, consider the heroes of faith in Hebrews chapter 11. And I would say this is kind of a 50-50. For everyone that God saved, God did not save from trials. Hebrews 11, verse 32. Notice how good it starts, right? Verse 32. "And what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, about David, Samuel, and the prophets who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Even women received back their dead, raised to life again." Doesn't that sound amazing? God spared all these people, came through miraculously, but watch this. In part B of verse 35, it says this, "But there were others who were tortured, refusing to be released so that they might gain even a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning." Ouch. Stephen, does he come to mind? Yep. "They were sawed in two." "They were killed by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, living in caves and holes in the ground. And you see sort of this kind of this one for one kind of deal that God rescues some, but others he does not. We'll never be able to fully comprehend why at certain times that God will come through and be that fourth person in the fire and bring his people out unscathed, and other times where he will allow them to lay down their life. But here's the deal, friends. We can struggle with that and wonder sometimes why, when we do the right thing, why do we not receive the blessings? Why don't we prosper like we think that we should? What we have to understand is that the rewards and the blessings that God has for us, many of them don't come until you get on that side. Did you catch that? Some come here, but the real payoff comes there. And sometimes a martyr's life, the laying and the shedding of blood, is exactly what it takes to reach an unsaved nation, a different people's group. Sometimes that giving of that life, the shedding of the blood, will cause the gospel to go forward in powerful ways. And in the end, God will receive the glory. And in the end, that person will receive the right reward. Our God sees everything. His purposes are high and holy and so far above us. And the attitude that we've got to resolve to have is when we face challenges and trials and difficulty, when we face darkness and are up close and personal, friends, our attitude should be this, that my God is able to save. But if he chooses not, I will not bow to you, O King, nor your idols. Would you stand with me?